Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcasts12. Just go to Indeed.com/podcasts12 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcasts12. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
Welcome to What's Eric Eating? Culture Map's bi-weekly look at all things Houston bars and restaurants. I'm your host, Culture Map editor Eric Sandler. We celebrated a bit of a milestone on the show last week with our 500th episode. To celebrate, I am doing something we have never done before. We are doing a mailbag episode. I asked on Instagram for your questions. About a dozen of you have responded. So we're just going to take them one by one. I probably shouldn't say this, but I'm going to anyway. This could go either really well or really poorly. Either it will be the first in a series of mailbag episodes, or we will never do this again, and I will deny it when you ask me about it in public. To participate in the discussion and to be the question asker, I am joined by Culture Map's home and design contributor, Emily Cotton. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Hello. Thank you for having me. I'm fine. Thanks for asking. I'm excited to join you on here, even though my voice is super annoying. But hey, that's all right.
Yeah. As a pescatarian and a gluten-free person, Emily is not really invited into the food discussion. So this will be most likely your first and last appearance on the show, unless I like fall down a flight of stairs and think that doing a vegetarian draft is a good idea.
That would be amazing.
All right. Emily, I'm going to turn it over to you. You have all of these delightful questions in front of you. So pick one and then we'll be off to the races.
Okie doke. Well, I'm going to be a nerd and go in order. So we will start with question number one from Sarah, who asks, will Chris Shepherd ever open another restaurant?
All right, Sarah, thank you for your question. My gut instinct is that if Chris's wife, Lindsay, has anything to say about it, that Chris will never open another restaurant. And I will say in my conversations with Chris, he seems incredibly happy. Since leaving his role with Underbelly Hospitality, he has obviously increased his role with the Southern Smoke Foundation, the organization that he founded. He travels all over the country doing fundraising events, participating in panels and food festivals and interviews on their behalf. And he's got the opportunity to do some consulting. I know he did some work for Robert Mondavi. He's got his Full Tilt Foods, that they've got hot dogs that you can get at Texans games. And so I think, if I had to guess, that if he is going to open a restaurant, it won't be soon. And it would be something really, really small. And very personal, and I'm not quite sure what form that would take. You know, the one other side of this that someone made the point to me recently is, you know, Brian Caswell has had such an incredible comeback at Latuli. Is that going to kind of give Chris the itch to open a new restaurant? To which I say, I don't know. I haven't asked Chris, but all of the times that we've talked about it, he has indicated that at least for now, he is done with the restaurant business.
Before we move on to question number two, I want to backtrack to what you were talking about, because if other people are like me, I mean, maybe I'm just the only person who doesn't know this, but what does he have at the ballpark? What are you talking about?
Yeah, so Chris started like a prepared foods company. And if you go to Texans games, at least in the club level, he's making hot dogs and you can buy his hot dogs. Also, he wrote an article about the hot dog tower at Brennan's of Houston. Those are also his hot dogs at Brennan's.
Huh. Huh. Okay. Cool. I will never use that information since I don't eat meat, but good to know. Okay. So question number two. Oh, no, that's not numbered. Okay. So we'll call it question 1A. It's from Michelle, who asks, any ingredient or food that you loathe?
All right. You actually know the answer to this question. Do you want to answer? Do you want to answer for me, or do I have to answer it myself?
That's right. You hate eggs.
I do. I hate eggs. It's not eggs. It's me. When I get asked about this, all I can say is that the smell of frying eggs, when my parents would make eggs and fry eggs in the kitchen, it turned my stomach, and I've just never made my peace with eggs. Like there are certain forms of eggs that I'm okay with, like a chawanmushi at a sushi restaurant I'm cool with. I love a souffle, but like scrambled eggs, omelets, eggs over easy, all of that kind of stuff, I can't do it. And my only egg-related story is that when Bottolina Bakery opened and I was touring it with Itai, the owner, he said, oh, we make a wonderful quiche. You have to try this. It was like onion and garlic and whatever quiche. And I was like, all right, Sandler, here we go. You're a man in your 40s. You're a professional food writer. Like, suck it up and eat the fucking quiche. And so I took a big forkful and I put it in my mouth and I went, mmm. And then I took two more bites of it and I took the rest home to my mother, who was delighted by it.
Excellent. But to be fair, I don't like the smell of eggs cooking either. Like, I won't cook eggs at home. I won't let anybody else cook eggs at home either. Like fried food, like deep frying something or eggs is a no-go for me. It smells gross and weird. And it takes forever. Like, I'm not trying to use like my expensive candles to cover up egg smells. Like, that's just not a thing that I'm going to do. You know what I mean? Like, good candles now, I swear to God, are like $200. Like, I'm not lighting a candle every time someone wants an omelet. I almost dropped the F-bomb. Sorry.
You are actually allowed to drop the F-bomb.
Oh, okay. Good.
So maybe later.
Maybe later. I'll save it for when it really counts.
All right. Are you ready for question three?
Yes, I am. Ralph asks, most starstruck moment, any that caused you to lose your train of thought during the interview?
All right. Well, as producer Michael will tell you, it does not require a star for me to lose my train of thought during the interview. As people know, I like the extemporaneous nature of this podcast. The price, of course, is that you hear me say, you know, a lot. That is the price to be paid for an extemporaneous podcast. But I will say the one time that I was really, well, there were a couple of times I've been starstruck, not even necessarily related to the podcast, but just being part of Culture Map. The first was, of course, meeting Anthony Bourdain, childhood, like someone I've been watching on television for years. I'd read his books. To be in the same room with him and have the opportunity to interview him, I played it as cool as I possibly could for the entire time, just like trying not to have that like Chris Farley on SNL moment of like, you're Anthony Bourdain. Like, what am I even doing in the same room with you?
What were you doing in the same room with him? Because I don't know what you're talking about. What are you talking about?
So Anthony Bourdain came to Houston to promote Balvenie's Scotch. And as part of the promotion, media members got, it was either like 5 minutes or 10 minutes to interview him. And so I was in a room with him for like a very short amount of time. And I had the questions written in advance. I was highly, much more organized than I am for this endeavor today. But, you know, just like trying to play it cool was difficult. And then the one other time was when Valober Jewelers opened their new location on Westheimer. It turns out that the owner is friends with Thomas Keller and Daniel Ballou. And so they flew in for the store opening. And I was talking to Chris Shepherd, the second time Chris Shepherd's coming up in this. And Daniel Ballou walks up to us and starts talking to us. And he looks at me and he goes, have you tried the charcuterie? And I said, no, chef, I haven't. And he said, may I make you a plate? And I said, yes, of course. But in my head, I'm thinking, sure, the most famous French chef in America, please make me a plate. I don't know what else you say to Daniel Ballou when he offers you food other than yes.
Right. I mean, I feel like, I don't know, you're like cooler about that kind of stuff than I am. Like, I don't care if I lose my shit. Like, I don't need, like, no one needs to think that I'm cool. I don't care. I would lose my shit. But Thomas Keller would have I would lose my shit for him for sure, because he holds a special place in my heart, because the French Laundry is the first restaurant that I know of, I could be very wrong, but that I ever knew of, that, you know, he has a vegetarian tasting menu at the French Laundry in Napa. And that was like, it's, I can never go to a lot of times to these cool food things, because I'm not going to be like, oh, hey, thanks. But also like, can you accommodate me? I'm so special, please. No. So I just don't go. So that was really cool to be able to like go and do an actual tasting menu and not have to worry about it. And so he will always be my favorite chef because of that, because, you know, vegetarian pride. Well, pescatarian, but you know what I mean.
Right. Well, my cool guy moment with Thomas Keller was that we're standing there and he has oysters. And so I go, excuse me, chef, are those the same oysters as the oysters in Pearl Dish from the French Laundry? And he goes, yes, as a matter of fact, they are. And I was like, ah, see, a moment of, I was like, I felt so cool in that moment.
Did you think that he thought you were cool, so you felt cool?
I don't think that he thought I was cool, but I was proud of myself.
Yeah, for knowing. I can see that. So let's go with, what did we do? Oh, we're on number three. Okay, so Colleen wants to know your favorite local cooking classes or chefs thinking of doing this. I would love to see more. Yeah, that is actually, that's a good question.
Yeah, the short answer is I don't know of very many chefs that are offering cooking classes locally. I will say Kaiser Lishkari from Himalaya is trying to get Himalaya Cooking School off the ground. And if you follow him on Facebook, you'll see that he's been kind of soliciting applications for students. And he's set up some sort of facility either in his home or near his home out in Sugar Land. And he is ready to teach people like most of the secrets of the Himalaya menu. So if you're already like adept in the kitchen, but you want to learn everything there possibly is to know about making Indo-Pak food, then Kaiser's your guy. Other than that, I will say Central Market does a really good job with all of their cooking classes. I've been in that facility before. I've been to a cooking class at Central Market. They're very engaging. They feed you. And they're pretty good about bringing in like cookbook authors, national cookbook authors on book tours. So that's a really good way to meet people. That's how I met Kenji Lopez Alt from the Food Lab and from social media and all kinds of stuff, because he was coming through town one day and did a cooking class at Central Market.
That's cool. And also just, you know, obviously Sur La Table has classes and stuff like that. But what's good to know is that the one that's in the Woodlands, on Market Street used to be like pretty small, so they could never have classes, but they have recently relocated and are like, they built out like a whole new like kitchen. So they're going to start having classes in the Woodlands too, for suburban people who don't want to have to go to River Oaks to, you know, go to a knives class.
Yes. And you know, I know that because Culture Map wrote an article about that.
Oh, really? My bad. All right. Well, anyway, moving on. Thomas wants to know, what are your top 10 meals since you've started the podcast? Top 10.
Yeah, no, we're not doing 10. The first thing is, I mean, I could do a whole podcast about top 10 meals of all time in Houston, top 10 meals of all time since I started the podcast. So we're not doing that. I was trying to figure out, you know, when I got this question, I was trying to figure out what were the meals that like truly blew me away or were like just completely exceptional compared to all of the other like really good eating that I get to do because I have this crazy job. The one that came to mind more than any other were all the special meals that I had with Austin Simmons at Tris, because Austin would always kind of show off for us. So like the one that comes to mind, and I think we've even talked about this on the show before, is when Michael Fulmer said something to him about doing prime rib for his birthday. So Austin did the whole primal, like this giant, like 5-pound massive hulking beef thing that he brought out on a wooden board, and the whole dining room got quiet and everybody kind of turned to look at us with, I think, kind of two thoughts in their head. One is, who the fuck are these guys?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And then like, what is that? Because that's not on the menu. And the answer to both of those things is like, don't worry about it. And like, no, it's not on the menu. And then, you know, I was trying to think like, Thomas, Thomas, you know, to out Thomas is Thomas Billy from Belly of the Beast, who just won a James Beard Award. I will say, like, one of my favorite meals was the first time I went to Belly of the Beast and had his, in the original Old Town Spring location, and had his tacos and his ceviches, because it was so unexpected, right? Like, it's kind of one thing to go to, like, a BCN or a Le Jardinet and have a really good meal because you're familiar with the reputation and you're expecting to have a good meal. It's another thing to pull up to a tiny little taqueria and not really, and be like, oh, this guy's from LA. Like, I don't know what the story is. I've heard that it's supposed to be good. But, you know, a lot of times there's like Facebook groups, when like the Facebook groups get excited about a place, it turns out not to be good. We're not, that wasn't one of the questions. So I won't name names, but anyway. But then to go to the original Belly of the Beast and to be like, oh wow, this is like, this is maybe the best birria taco I've ever had. These ceviches are like the equal of any I've had anywhere else in town. Just to get excited about it, that was really fun. But then some of those big hype, like even the big time meals, like do live up to the hype. I mean, I've had meals at March that just like blew me away with just how, not like both how delicious they were and like how well the staff takes care of you. And I know that like I'm set up to receive a heightened level of service almost anywhere, but they do that for everybody. And then either the first meal at Katami or the second meal at Katami, where Hori kind of really just showed off the menu, all the fresh sashimi from Japan, all the Wagyu beef, a beautiful bottle of sake. Just, you know, that was a restaurant where I was really, really looking forward to it. And even on top of that, it kind of exceeded the expectations. And then my first meal at Neo, where they were still kind of figuring things out, but it was just so, it was like, it's like, I've never had sushi like this before. Mm-hmm. I've never had these flavors in sushi before. Like, you know, you walk into that clothing store and you don't know what to expect. And then like, this is kind of before they had really built their reputation. I mean, now I think people know it as one of the like great omakase meals in Houston, but at the time it was still like an unexpected surprise.
Interesting. And those are your top, what was that, three?
Yeah, three-ish, four-ish. I don't know. You want another one?
Ten. You could do halfway.
Meet him halfway. Please. Hey, all right.
Easy Street, Eric.
Thanks. You know, this is like apropos of nothing, but like meals that kind of caught me off guard or surprised me in a delightful way. I remember the first time Justin Yu did his Houston's menu inspired by Houston's. It was during the pandemic. It was to go only. You had to like order in advance and pick it up and mask up and all of that stuff. But, you know, at a time when we were all like kind of freaked out about restaurants and especially fine dining restaurants that had to close their dining rooms, like that menu felt really good. And kind of made me feel like, okay, like if Justin can figure this out and do something special in his 22 seat restaurant, there's no social distancing in that place. Maybe this is going to be okay.
Interesting. All right. So where are we now? Okay. There we go. From Elizabeth, what are your favorite industry nights?
All right, I have to admit, I have no idea where there are industry nights. I can barely keep track of happy hours, and so I don't know. I honestly would say like this would be a great idea for an article. So if there are bar and restaurant owners that are out there running specials for your colleagues in the restaurant industry, email me, eric@culturemap.com, DM me on Instagram, send smoke signals, I don't know, whatever. But yeah, I have no idea where the good industry nights are anymore.
Yeah, me neither. I feel like if I had to guess, though, I'm willing to bet that Jeff has some good ones at one of his places. So, like, probably, like, Wooster's or Heights Beer Garden or, like, places like that, I feel like.
Well, and then there are, like, bars that are kind of industry-friendly or, like the Winnie's $6 burger or whatever their special is on Mondays. Like, that's not pitched to the industry. Anybody can have that. But it's on a night where a lot of people in the industry are off. And if you go to Winnie's for a burger, you'll see a lot of people in the industry. You know, like that group, like Starduster, Winnie's, Johnny's, like they're very good about taking care of their industry colleagues with like good food and drink specials.
Asked Ralph about that. I bet Ralph would have known. Ralph like is always in places like that.
Yeah, or like
call out Ralph. Like Ralph's always in a bar. Like,
well, and Ralph likes Nickel City, right?
And Easy's. He's always in those places.
Yeah, which are industry friendly kind of places.
Yeah, yeah. So he would have known. Whoops, our bad. Okay, cool. So next we are at, how do I say, is that Privet?
Sure.
Okay, I'm going to go to the British way with that one. All right, so with a lot of our restaurants closing, RIP Riel, oh my God, what Houston stronghold do you miss the most?
Yeah, it's really hard to come up with one restaurant like in the entire run of the show or my time at Culture Map because it covers, Underbelly, it covers Oxheart, it covers the Passive Provisions, it covers, well, we'll come back to that. But this is now it's time for me. It's my favorite. So the one that comes to mind, the one that still to this day stings a little bit is Bernadine's, which was Graham Laborde's Southern restaurant in the Heights. It's not even that I can like think of like specific dishes. Like I remember they did like a crazy, like instead of like a seafood tower, they did like a, it had like raw oysters, but also like chicharrones and, you know, like a cured seafood situation, like a mussel, whatever, pickled mussels or whatever. Like it varied a little bit, but you know, there were steaks, there was seafood, there was po' boys. I mean, really, like I feel like Bernadine's walked so that restaurants like Eunice and Josephine's and some of these other like modern, like Gulf Coast inspired places could run.
Sure.
All right. You want to say something about the Passing Provisions?
I missed it, but honestly, if there was one thing that has closed that I missed the most for sure, and that I'm just like I was devastated by, it was Philippe Schmidt's foray into bistro life with PS21, which I feel like was poorly named. I feel like if he had gone with Bistro Philippe or something and people could like recognize it, I think that he put a little bit too much faith in people thinking that they would, because all it said was PS21, and finally they put a thing that said restaurant on it, but it didn't tell you anything. And as much as I wish that everyone in Houston listened to Culture Map or read Culture Map, they just don't. So just relying on either influencers or, you know, outlets like Culture Map to get the word out of what kind of restaurant and stuff it is, I think it's problematic. You know, you kind of have to put it out there on the sign exactly what it is, and there's no guesswork. Because that food was amazing. That lunch special was insane. What was it like? Oh my gosh, you could eat lunch there and have like the most amazing food for like $20. Not even. It was insane. I miss it so much.
Yeah, no. PS21 sounds like a public school in New York City.
Yeah.
It sounds like an elementary school.
Yeah, you could not, like, people had no idea what it was. I mean, the patio helped a little bit, especially whenever they illuminated it. But yeah, I miss it so much because the food was so good. The cocktails were incredible and no one ate there. And I could cry about it. It was so delicious. And now I will never have that cocktail again. Remember after they closed, I thought about trying to run down the recipe. I should text Philippe and ask him about it for some of their cocktails. They were the best cocktails in town, 100%.
Yeah, no, they had great cocktails. Like French food is never going to be my first choice.
It's like French fries and paninis and like delicious stuff. And no one went there. It's infuriating. I can flip this desk over thinking about it. Ugh.
Please don't.
I will not. I picked this desk out and it's glass and I don't want to have to try to hunt it down a second time. So no desk flipping for you. So Josh wants to know, what food or dining trend were you excited about only for it not to catch on here or otherwise?
You know, I keep waiting for Korean food to become a thing in Houston. It's been so successful in New York and Los Angeles and other cities around the country. And we keep trying versions of it, right? We tried, you know, Dak and Bop just closed a couple weeks ago. We haven't really talked about it on the show, but most of our Korean fried chicken is either like in the neighborhood, like off of Long Point, or, you know, the Banchan franchises that have kind of popped up around town. And I don't understand why it's not more popular because it's twice fried, so it's so crispy and so juicy and so delicious, and you can get it spicy. And the same thing with like Korean barbecue. It just seems like such a no-brainer that we should be into as like meat-obsessed Texans. Like if you like a churrascaria where they slice the meat on swords in front of you, then you should be totally down with a Korean barbecue spot where you grill it, you know, at your table. But it seems like the only kind of high-end place that's kind of crossed over to capture like not just a Korean audience or like not just adventurous diners is Bori, because they opened, you know, they've got their Spring Ranch location and then the Montrose location that opened about a year ago. But like, you know, Mapo Jung, Ken Bridges' place, like came and went over the course of a few years. And, you know, Carne, Jason Cho of Dak and Bop tried to do Carne in the Heights. And there were things about Carne that I really liked, but it just never caught on. And just, I mean, there's a whole world of like Korean dumplings and, you know, noodle dishes and all that stuff. And it's very heavily embedded in New York City. And obviously I think Los Angeles has more Koreans than any city that's not in Korea, like any city other than Seoul, just huge Korean population in LA. And it has never come here. And I don't, or like, and people keep trying to do it and it never quite catches on. And I don't understand why not.
That's like too, Korean food's too meat forward for me to pay any attention to it. Like I have no business in a Korean restaurant. Like what am I going to eat? That like puffy tortilla thing? You know what I mean? Like sometimes like, what is that called? There's like that white, it's like bread, but kind of not. It's like a little circle and they wrap the meat in it. And it's like really puffy something.
You mean a bao?
Yes. There you go. Okay. That's what it is. That's like all I can eat. You could just give me one naked bao, I guess.
And yeah, they do like an egg grid. They do the that's, pancakes.
That's probably wheat anyway, or is it rice?
Oh no. Yeah. It's wheat. Yeah.
So fuck it. I can't have any Korean food.
No, the whole country is closed to you.
Yeah. Okay. Well, all right. Moving on. So we have, let's see, Aza. Is that how you say that?
Asa.
Oh, my bad. Okay. How many of your listeners do you think are industry?
You know, it's hard to tell how many listeners are industry. I think it's a substantial portion of the audience because generally speaking, industry people, when I see them like out in public, they want to talk to me about the show. And part of that, I think, is that it's a good way to like suck up to me and flatter me is to ask me about the podcast. But I also think they're sincerely interested because they ask specific questions about things they heard or they share it on social media. That's always the nicest compliment. And I really value that, you know, all kidding aside, I really value how much people in the industry like listening to the show because it means that it's relevant and it means that it's honest in its conversations about what's happening and that it gives people in the industry a platform to talk about things that maybe don't get talked about elsewhere in the media. So, you know, is it a quarter? Is it half? Is it whatever? I don't really know. I just know that it's substantial and that I think it's great. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, for sure. Every time like I go anywhere with you, it's like everyone always wants to like talk to you. That's what dining out with you always takes forever. I'm sure like Bree would agree too, because well, you guys are both food writers. Everyone wants to talk to you guys. And I'm just sitting there just like, anyway, this light fixture is nice. So like, so yeah, I believe that you have a lot of industry listeners for sure. I only listen to you though because I know you, because most of the stuff I'm not going to eat anyway. All right. So let's see. Jim would like to know top 1, 3, or 5 iconic Houston dishes served more than 20 years at a local spot.
All right. Obviously, there is a very clear most iconic dish in Houston, and it is the fajitas at Ninfa's. Ninfa's is where fajitas al carbon were popularized. It's where the idea of serving them on a sizzling comal originated. It went global with the flour tortillas and the guacamole and the pico de gallo and the cheese and the sour cream. Like all of that started at Ninfa's and went international. So for me, I think that is such a clear number one. And then from there, it gets a little funkier. It's a little harder to like, you know, like Robert Del Grande's coffee rub filet mignon from Cafe Annie also kind of went global and was emblematic of Southwestern cuisine. But I just don't, it's just not as popular. And it's, you know, it's kind of still rooted in like the 80s and 90s. So I don't think it's as enduring a dish as fajitas. I mean, I think there's a million banh mi spots around town where you could be like, you know, the banh mi is kind of our civic sandwich. Like we may not have East Coast style hoagies, but we have banh mi for days. You know, if you said it's the one at Cali Sandwich, like I wouldn't argue with you. I think that's a, a reasonable pick for that. Then there are like our versions of dishes that people like go back to again and again, right? Like a Beck's Prime cheeseburger grilled over mesquite. You know, that's not unique to Houston, but it's a very Houston version of that dish. Or like a deep dish pizza at Star. It may not be like the best pizza you've ever had, but I think it's the most Houston pizza in the sense that it's fed generations of Houstonians and that people really kind of go for it. You know, I guess, you know, the one other one for me would be the bagels from what growing up was called New York Bagels, but is now for the last several years been the Bagel Shop Bakery, the bagel bakery on Hillcroft near Braeswood. I mean, that's another place. It's been around since the 70s. I've literally been eating there my entire life. And so, you know, as a Jewish Houstonian, Bagel Shop Bakery and Three Brothers Bakery are like very iconic for our community. And so they're the places that I think about. But then like after that, like if you're in the South Asian community, you know, it's the goat chops at Aga's. If you're, you know, in the Chinese community, it's, you know, it's somewhere, you know, maybe it's dim sum at Ocean Palace or at Fung's Kitchen or something like that. If you're, you know, if you're in the Black community, it's probably fried chicken at Frenchie's or the chicken and waffles at the Breakfast Club. Like there's like, you know, Houston is so diverse and our food tastes are so diverse. And so, you know, the restaurants that we prize are varied. The only other one that comes to mind off the top of my head, the pecan pie at Good Company. That's about as iconic a Houston dessert as I think there is.
I'm surprised that you didn't say anything about Brennan's. I would say that the turtle soup at Brennan's, as much as it pains me to say turtle soup, that's to me is like so Houston, like very iconic Houston.
Yeah, no, I think Brennan's, like everything about Brennan's is kind of iconic on its, right? Like turtle soup.
Jazz brunch,
Snapper Pontchartrain, Bananas Foster. Mm-hmm. Like even though it's all imported from New Orleans, even though it's related to Commander's Palace, that restaurant's been around for closing in on 60 years.
Yeah.
And yeah, everything they do is just kind of iconic.
Yeah. So I feel like you can't pass saying something about Brennan's when we're talking about stuff like that. I think too, that if Holly's had stayed around, you remember that fish, that stand up fish that was so good. I feel like that would have become an iconic thing for sure. Cause like when people, like when you saw that coming out, like out of the kitchen into the table, everyone was always like, what the hell is happening right now?
Well, all right. I have good news for you. He still does that Thai style snapper at Davis Street.
Shut your mouth. What is Davis Street?
It's Mark Holly's current restaurant.
I didn't know he had another restaurant.
Have you considered listening to this podcast and or reading Culture Map?
Fair enough. I do listen to this podcast at the gym, but I only started going to the gym like last year. So I've got a ways to go. I'm working backwards.
So. You know, you mentioned the snapper. The one other seafood dish, since we're talking about this, is the salt crusted snapper at Tony's.
Okay.
It comes out on fire in the middle of the dining room.
Maybe not say anything about that. Yeah. Okay. That's for sure. That's probably the most iconic Houston thing.
No, the most iconic Houston thing is the fajitas at Ninfa's, but the salt crusted snapper at Tony's has to be on that list somewhere.
Yeah, for sure. So next question we have from Anthony. What's the cuisine or dish, not restaurants, that you keep coming back to?
I have to say, I come back to everything eventually, right? Like if I haven't had barbecue in a while, I'll start craving barbecue. If I haven't had Vietnamese food in a while, I'll start craving Vietnamese food. If I haven't had Tex-Mex in a while, it's time for fajitas and enchiladas. So I come back to everything eventually. I will say I grew up, you know, I am who I am. I grew up, you know, Jewish deli is a comfort food. So there are times where, you know, a corned beef sandwich, a pastrami sandwich, a potato knish from Kenny and Ziggy's is like all I want in the world. I mentioned Star Pizza already, but that deep dish Joe's, the spinach and garlic pizza, is a dish that I just crave irrationally from time to time. And then American style Chinese food. Like I love that we have so many Sichuan restaurants in this town. And I'm happy to see like more regional options for dim sum and everything else. But like at the end of the day, like there are just days when like I want fat egg rolls, fried pork dumplings and beef with broccoli. And I'm not super picky about where I get it from. I go to the Rice Box for that a lot. I'll go to Chin Dynasty in West U for that stuff. I live close to Kim San, so they're kind of my go-to for wonton soup. But I mean, that, like, when I don't feel well or when I don't know what I want to eat or when I don't feel like leaving my house, Chinese takeout is my go-to cuisine.
I say that's fair. I feel like a lot of people, that's their like weird sick food. I always order takeout Chinese when I'm sick. And I feel like everyone I know does. So let's see. Craig would like to know, are you a flour guy or a corn tortilla guy?
All right. So this feels like the people who want to be like, I like ramen, but not pho, or I like pho, but not ramen. You can actually like both. You can like corn tortillas and flour tortillas, everything in its right context, right? Like if I'm eating like a traditional Mexican taco, like cochinita pibil or carnitas or something, flour tortilla, or I screwed that up. I built it up and then I screwed it up. If I'm eating traditional Mexican street tacos like carnitas or cochinita pibil or bisteca or lengua, corn tortillas always, always, preferably nixtamalized, but like I'm not that fussy in a street taco kind of context. And then, but like for Tex-Mex, right, for fajitas or breakfast tacos, flour tortillas forever and ever.
Well, I hate flour tortillas, but I will say, like for like the whole corn tortilla thing, I feel like anytime you try to put like a seafood in anything that's flour, that like it, I feel like it's always weird. I feel like for seafood taco stuff, it has to be corn tortilla. I don't know what it is. There's just something about seafood in a flour tortilla that makes everything too smushy. Like the consistency is goofy. I'm not into it.
Okay, I have to admit, I have not considered this. Fish tacos, though, like a fried fish taco, is definitely a flour tortilla for
me. No, absolutely not. Total lies. My ass gets the Taco Tuesday special at Skeeter's every Tuesday, and I obviously get the fish taco. And if that were ever in flour, it would be disgusting. Like, no, absolutely not. No, no, you're crazy. No, corn tortilla, it has to be.
All right.
Have to have that little bit of crunch with seafood, or it's too smushy. It's weird.
But that's what the frying is for.
Oh, see, I do them grilled.
Okay.
That's not true. Sometimes I get it fried, but I don't like the batter. So, you know.
Stiff snap, stiff snap, stiff snap.
Anyway, all right. Enough on that. So, let's see. Zach would like to know, how often do you eat at a restaurant and predict its demise? I know the answer to this one, but I'll let you go.
I will say it happens from time to time that I will go to a restaurant and be like, ooh, I don't think this is working.
I would say 98% of the time you're accurate.
No, I feel like I'm wrong. Like there are restaurants that I don't like that persist for reasons that escape my understanding. There are restaurants that I love. And I talked about this a couple episodes ago with Jonathan Horowitz. Like, I don't understand why Saltillo failed. It was a Mexican steakhouse. It had a pretty good location in Bel Air. Food was delicious. Their enchiladas were fantastic. And it just never caught on.
Probably because it's in Bel Air.
Yeah, but they like
Bel Air.
But Bel Air people need somewhere to eat.
The only reason that I ever even went out to La Tuli and, you know, off of wherever that is because it was Brian Caswell and Reef was my favorite restaurant ever. You know, I have done my 25th birthday party at that restaurant. You know how long ago that was?
6 weeks.
Yeah, it was 6 weeks ago. But I love that restaurant. La Tuli is probably currently one of my favorite restaurants for sure. I love that place so much. And it's so beautiful, obviously, since I wrote about it. But
yeah, no, I will say it is rare that I walk into a restaurant and just feel like they are really off track, like so off track that it's not going to work out. I think what's more likely is that you go to an established restaurant that you haven't been to in a while and things feel a little bit off. Right. Like it's not as busy or the food's not as good as you remember it. And then you start to wonder about, ooh, like maybe it's not long for this world. But then like there are restaurants that I thought were terrible that lingered like through the whole length of their 5-year lease term before they finally succumbed and closed down. Like it's, and you know, for every restaurant that I've wondered about whether or not it would close, there are restaurants I love that close out of nowhere. Like I'm still mad about Riel.
Obviously.
You know, I'm still hurt that, like, even though, like, even though I know that it's kind of working out for the best, and even though I know, you know, I'll have Ryan LeShane and Bobby Matos on next week to talk about what's going on at State of Grace now that Ryan's there. So we'll get their perspective on that. But yeah, it's rare. It's rare to walk into a place and just feel like this isn't working and this isn't going to be around long. And then to be right, because, you know, sometimes places that, like, even when they don't work, like, they do one thing so well that they're just popular and the neighborhood loves them.
I don't know. I feel like every time you say something's going to close, it does. But going back to the corn tortilla conversation, I know I just, like, cannot let this go. What's the place that only does all the stuff with all the different corn that you always tell me to go eat that's like, that I would love it?
Totemo.
Yes. That's the one. I thought that they should get an honorable mention since they're, like, all about the corn.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Totemo is talking about, like, great meals of the tenure of this podcast, iconic dishes of this podcast, like, whatever. I mean, what Emmanuel has done from going from selling tortillas, like, from selling corn tortillas at a farmer's market to being a three-time James Beard finalist, a mm-hmm. Food and Wine Best New Chef winner, like, one of the modern faces of the Houston culinary scene, Michelin star holder, is, like, one of the most extraordinary, like, underdog stories in Houston.
Absolutely.
And it does kind of feel like one of those things that could only happen here, just like Street to Kitchen winning a James Beard Award when they were still in the gas station.
Love them.
Feels like could only happen in Houston. You know, so yeah, nobody asked me, like, what my, I don't know, my top 10 restaurants of the podcast era are, but, like, I think probably Totemo and Street to Kitchen would have to be on that list.
Yeah, for sure. It's ridiculous that I haven't eaten there yet. Like, it's everything that I would love in a place. And the fact that I haven't gone there is absurd. Well, soon.
Yeah, sounds like that's you've got a birthday coming up ish.
Yeah, January. But isn't it, like, really small?
Yeah.
Do you have, like, people there?
No, it's you could have a four top. You could have three friends.
Okay. All right. That'll work. That's fine.
Michael Carroll, before we wrap this up, do you have any questions?
Besides who's your favorite producer and why?
Well, obviously it's Michael Carroll because he makes me sound like a radio professional, even though I very much am not.
I try my best. I would ask, what's been your favorite episode of the podcast?
You know, I was thinking about that. I love all the draft episodes because they're so much fun to do and because they're so different. The one that comes to mind is really obscure, but do you remember when we had Lindsay Ray and Michael Neff on, two bartenders?
Yes, I remember that.
And they were so engaging and so funny and just so delightful to talk to. Like, they're in the What's Eric Eating, like, guest hall of fame, along with, obviously, Ryan LeShane, Aaron Bluedorn, Morgan Weber. I don't know. Who else? Who else would be on that list? Like, because you've listened to almost every single one of these. Those are the ones who come to mind off the top of my head. I've been thinking about this a little bit, but the people who've been on, like, multiple times, those are the ones who kind of stand out.
Yeah, those are great standout ones. I'm trying to, who did we just have not too long ago? And it was super engaging. I have to look at the list now because I'm
Kristen Epps, like, yeah. in a debut appearance was really incredible. And I've gotten a lot of compliments on that. And I saw Tristan's partner at the Southern Smoke Festival. And she said that he's also heard from people on his end saying how much they enjoyed that interview.
It was such a good interview because it's nice when you get that engagement, you know, that just wonderful engagement that Tristan brought. The one I was thinking of was, Justin Yu, of course.
Oh yeah. Justin, who famously was like, didn't want to do the show for years and then finally did the show and likes doing the show and, like, doesn't like show a lot of his personality on social media, I think. Mm-hmm. And so that he's kind of used this podcast as the forum to showcase just, like, how funny he is and how smart he is. And so, like, we do the Bear recaps and he won the date night draft and has judged another draft. I mean,
The Bear Like the Show?
Yeah, The Bear Like the Show. Oh. Yeah. Yeah, so there are ways in which the character of the bear's career is similar to what Justin has done in actual real life. Mm-hmm. So he's a huge fan of the show, and I, as you know, am a huge fan of the show. So for the last three seasons, he's come on with me to talk about what we liked and didn't like about that season of the show.
Oh, I guess I haven't listened to any of those. That sounds interesting. I love The Bear. So I feel like I would. So now I feel like I need to look at those episodes, because whenever a new season comes out, I do that like super weird thing that people do when they have terrible memories, like I do. And I just rewatch the whole series up until whenever the show comes out so that I remember stuff. Because otherwise, it'll come on and it'll be like a main character. And I'll be like, who's this guy? You know, so I have to do the full rewatch. But I feel like if I listen to the podcast too, I would know if people agree or disagree with my weird takes on things on the show, since I, you know, don't discuss the TV shows with anyone else. I can just listen to your podcast at the gym and argue with you to myself.
Yes, you're going to, and then you're going to like call me and argue with me in real life, actually, in addition to arguing with me in your head.
That is probably true, especially if I've like had anything to drink at all. I'll FaceTime you and I'll bitch at you. 100%. You can set a clock to that always.
Just one of the delightful things about being your friend.
It's drunk FaceTimes.
Yeah, drunk, argumentative FaceTimes with Emily. Yeah. All right, Michael Carroll, I think this is a good place to wrap this up, yes?
I think so. I just wanted to throw in that I also like the episodes where we're reacting to news, whether it's the Michelin announcements or early, you know, back in May we did the Texas Monthly reactions, like stuff like that is also really cool because you get unique insight during those episodes, I think.
That's true. The time pressure, and I mean, I will say, like, getting Leonard Botello from Truth and Ernest Cervantes from Burnt Bean Company when he had just been named number one that morning was really incredible. And Ernest has been a tremendous friend and supporter of me. And so he did us, he had a million people trying to get a hold of him that day. And he gave us, I don't know, like 45 minutes that he probably didn't really have. So yeah, if people didn't catch that episode, go back and listen to that. Cause he was so candid and so honest. Mm-hmm. It was incredible. Like it wasn't about me, right? It was just like me kind of asking the questions that I think anybody would. And then him appreciating this moment that he found himself in. Yeah, that was a great episode.
Yeah, I really like that one.
Don't we have a Michelin thing coming up?
We do have a Michelin thing coming up on October 28th. So yes, we'll have a Michelin reaction pod. I don't know, probably on October 29th. Michael, we should schedule that. I should figure things out for that.
Sounds good. We'll schedule that.
Okay, great. I just realized that I didn't ask you a question, a restaurant question.
Oh, yeah, ask Emily Cotton. You get the last question.
You get the last question. I feel like it should be a crossover question. Since, this is obvious. Okay. What, or you might not want to answer it, but we'll see. What do you think design wise, what do you think is it's a two-parter. I want to know what you think is the prettiest restaurant. And I want to know what you think is the most comfortable restaurant. Ooh.
All right. The prettiest restaurant I think is Eunice. I really like what Jen Braverman did at Eunice. It's got those big windows, high ceilings, those lighting fixtures. It's just, it's coastal. Like, it feels coastal without being, like, seafood cliche, you know?
It's light and bright. Yeah, there's no, like, we might have, like, fishnets or, like a big marlin. No,
they don't have, like, a fish tank or any of that stuff.
Yeah, okay. All right. And then most comfortable.
Ooh.
Like, where can you just cozy up and sit and have a meal for hours?
You know, the place that I am most, I think the place that I feel the most comfortable is probably Bluedorn. I just really like, they've got these like kind of wide banquettes. Uh-huh. And I've had so many meals there that have like gone on for 2-3 plus hours and I still feel comfortable. I don't have to like shift myself or move around or anything. Like I at least at first, like without any preparation, without thinking about all the places I'm like slighting by not mentioning them, I think it's Bluedorn.
Okay. That's fair for sure. All right. Thank you. Now I'm good.
All right. Well, then I'm going to say that's it for our first ever mailbag. If you are happy with this episode, then I thank you for listening. If you're unhappy about this episode, then email me better questions the next time we decide to do a mailbag episode.
For sure. Just FaceTime me. I'll deal with it.
Yeah, you can. I'll send you. You can DM Emily Cotton on Instagram, and you can argue with her.
There you go.
All right. In all seriousness, 500 episodes, as I said on the 500th episode, is not something I ever really thought about or aspired to. But without the support of the listeners and my guests and my co-hosts and my producer, is not something I ever would have achieved. So sincerely, this has been a lot of fun, and we've been kind of joking around, but very sincerely, thank you for listening to the show. Thank you for supporting the show. Thank you for asking me about the show. Thank you for encouraging me to continue doing the show. So yeah, I'm going to keep doing the show. We'll be back to normal on Thursday, when my guest will be Anthony DeMeo from Coastline Pizza, and then normal co-host, News of the Week, Restaurants of the Week, all that stuff starting next week. So again, follow me on Instagram at Eric Sandler. Keep it locked on culturemap.com for all the latest Houston bar and restaurant news. Thanks so much for listening. I'll be back on Thursday.